I've stolen a chisel from a mason who passed by on his way to work on the minster at York. It will take some time, but if you work on a single stone, you might escape in summer. You are my escape pocket, the only escape I can ever allow myself. But we could run off, be together. That would be smashing, except I can't leave. So hop up and get your tackle in the cross. Talia's a special treat for you. I never seemed to make my point once my tackle went in the cross. Distracted I was. But I learned. And while I was forbidden confession, and to tell the truth, I didn't feel that badly about it, I began to share what I had learned. Talia, I must confess to you. I have told Sister Nikki about the little man in the boat.
Really? Told her or showed her?
Well, showed her, I reckon. But she seems a bit thick. She kept making me show her over and over. Asked me to meet her in the cloisters to show her again after Vespers tonight.
Ah, the joy of being slow. Still, it's a sin to be selfish with one's knowledge.
That's what I thought, said I, relieved.
And speaking of the little man in the boat, I believe there is one on this side of the loop who has been naughty and requires a thorough tongue-lashing.
Aye, mistress, said I, wedging my cheeks into the arrow loop. Present the rascal for punishment. And so it went. I was the only person I knew who had calluses on his cheekbones, but I had also developed the arms and grip of a blacksmith from suspending myself with my fingertips wedged between the great stones to extend my bits through the arrow loop. And thus I hung, spread spider-like across the wall, my business being tended to frantic and friendly by the anchoress, when the bishop entered the antechamber. The bishop entered the antechamber. The bishop entered the antechamber. At this point you're going coy on us, euphemizing about parts and positions when you've already confessed to mutual violation with a holy woman through a bloody arrow slot? Well, no. The actual sodding bishop of bloody York entered the sodding antechamber with Mother Sodding Basil, who bore a brace of sodding storm lanterns. And so I let go. Unfortunately, Talia did not. It appeared that her grip, too, had been strengthened by our encounters on the wall.
"What the hell are you doing, Pocket?" said the anchoress.
"What are you doing?"
asked Mother Basil. I hung there, more or less suspended to the wall by three points, one of them not covered by shoes.
"Ah,"
said I. I was finding it somewhat difficult to think.
"Give us a little slack, lad," said Talia. This is meant to be more of a dance, not a tug of war.
The bishop is out here, said I. She laughed. Well, tell him to get in the queue and I'll tend to him when we're finished. No, Talia, he's really out here.
Oh, toss,
said she, releasing my knob. I fell to the floor and quickly rolled onto my stomach. Talia's face was at the arrow loop.
Evening, Your Grace.
A big grin there.
Fancy a spot of stony bonking before Vespers?
The bishop turned so quickly his mitre went half-past on his head.
Hang him, he said.
He snatched one of Mother Basil's lanterns and walked out of the chamber.
Bloody brown bread you serve tastes like goat's scrotum, Talia called after. A lady deserves finer fare.
Talia, please, I said.
Not a comment on you, Pocket. Your serving style is lovely, but the bread is rubbish.
Then to Mother Basil,
don't blame the boy, Reverend Mother. He's a love.
Mother Basil grabbed me by the ear and dragged me out of the chamber.
You're a love, Pocket,
said the anchoress. Mother Basil locked me in a closet in her chambers, then midway through the night, opened the door and handed in a crust of bread and a chamber pot. Stay here until the bishop is on his way in the morning, and if anyone asks, you've been hung. Yes, Reverend Mother, said I. She came to get me the next morning and hustled me out through the chapel. I've never seen her so distraught. You've been like a son to me, Pocket, she said, fussing about me, strapping a satchel and other bits of kit on me.
So it's going to pain me to send you off.
But, Reverend Mother...
Hush, lad. We'll take you to the barn, hang you in front of a few farmers, then you're off to the south to meet up with a group of mummers who will take you in.
Begging pardon, Mum, but if I'm hung, what will Mummers do with me? A puppet show?
I'll not really hang you. Just make it look good. We have to, lad. The bishop ordered it.
Since when does the bishop order nuns to hang people?
Since you shagged the anchor's pocket.
At the mention of her, I broke away from Mother Basil, ran through the abbey, down the old corridor and into the antechamber. The arrow cross was gone, completely bricked up and mortared in. Talia! Talia! I called. I screamed and beat the stones until my fists bled, but not a sound came from the other side of the wall. Ever. The sisters pulled me away, tied my hands, and took me to the barn, where I was hanged.
Seven. A brother traitor. Am I to be forever alone? The anchors told me it might be so, trying to comfort me when I felt pushed aside by the sisters of dog-snogging.
You're gifted with wit, Pocket, but to cast gibe and jest, you must stand separate from the target of your barbs. I fear you may become a lonely man, even in the company of others.
Perhaps she was right. Perhaps it is why I'm such an accomplished hornbeast and eloquent crafter of cuckoldry. I seek only succour and solace beneath the skirts of the soft and understanding. And so, sleepless, did I make my way to the great hall to find some comfort among the castle wenches who slept there. The fire still blazed, logs the size of oxen set in before bed. My sweet Squeak, who had oft opened her heart and what-not to a wayfaring fool, had fallen asleep in the arms of her husband, who spooned her mercilessly as he snored. Shanker Mary was not to be seen, no doubt servicing the bastard Edmund somewhere. And my other standard lovelies had fallen into slumber in proximity too close to husbands or fathers to admit a lonely fool. Ah, but the new girl, just in the kitchen a fortnight, called Tess, or Kate, or possibly Fiona. Her hair was jet and shone like oiled iron. Milky skin, cheeks brushed by a rose. She smiled at my japes and had given Drool an apple without his asking. I am relatively sure that I adored her. I tiptoed across the rushes that lined the floor. I had left Jones in my chamber, his hat bells no help in securing stealthy romance. Lay down beside her and introduced my personage to the nether of her blanket. An affectionate nudge at the hip woke her.
"Hello,"
said she.
"Hello,"
said I. "Not a papist, are you, love?"
"Christ, no. Druid, born and raised."
"Thank God."
"What are you doing under my blanket?"
"Warming up. I'm terribly cold."
"No, you're not."
"Brrr, freezing."
"It's hot in here."
"All right, then. I'm just being friendly."
"Would you stop prodding me with that?"
"Sorry, it does that when it's lonely."
"Perhaps if you petted it."
"Then, praised be the merciful goddess of the wood, she petted it, tentatively. Almost reverentially at first, as if she sensed how much joy it could bring to all who came in contact with it. An adaptable lass, not given to fits of hysteria or modesty. And soon, a gentle surety in her grip that betrayed some experience in the handling of manly bits. Simply lovely she was.
"I thought it would have a little hat with bells."
"Ah, yes. Well, given a private place to change, I'm sure that can be arranged. Under your skirt, perhaps. Roll to the side, love. Will be less obvious if we keep the cuddle on a lateral plane." I popped her bosoms out of a frock then, freed the roly-poly pink-nosed puppies to the firelight and the friendly ministries of this master juggler, and thought to burble my cheeks softly between them when the ghost appeared. The spirit was more substantial now, features describing what must have been a most comely creature before she was shuffled off to the undiscovered country, no doubt by a close relative weary of her irritating nature. She floated above the sleeping form of the cook, Bubble, rising and falling on the draught of her snores.
"Sorry to haunt you while you're rogering the help," said the ghost.
"The rogering has not commenced, Wisp. I have barely bridled the horse for a moist and bawdy ride. Now go away."
"Right then, Sorry to have interrupted your attempted rudgering.
Are you calling me a horse? Asked possibly Fiona.
Not at all, love. You pet the little jester and I'll attend to the haunting.
There's always a bloody ghost about, isn't there?
Commented possibly, a squeeze on my knob for emphasis.
When you live in a keep where blood runs blue and murder is the favoured sport, yes,
said the ghost.
Oh, do fuck off, said I, thou visible stench, thou steaming aggravation, thou vaporous nag. I'm wretched, sad and lonely and trying to raise a modicum of comfort and forgetting here in the arms of,
Kate,
said possibly Fiona.
Really?
She nodded. Not Fiona?
Kate, since the day me dad tied me belly cord to a tree.
Well, bugger. Sorry. Pocket here. Called the black fool. Charmed, I'm sure. Shall I kiss your hand?
Double-jointed then, are ya?
Said Kate, a tickle to my tackle making a point.
Bloody hell, would you two shut up? Said the ghost. I'm haunting over here.
Go on, said we. The ghost boosted her bosom and cleared her throat, expectorating a tiny ghost frog that evaporated in the firelight with a hiss, then said,
When a second sibling's base derision proffers lies that cloud the vision and severs ties that families bind, shall a madman rise to lead the blind?
What? Said the former Fiona.
What? Said I.
Prophecy of doom, innit? Said the ghost. Spot the old Ridley foreshadowing from beyond, don't you know?
Can't kill her again, can we? Asked faux Fiona.
Gentle spook, said I. If it is a warning you bring, state it true. If action you require, ask outright. If music you must make, play on. But by the wine-stained balls of Bacchus, speak your bloody business, quick and clear, then be gone before time's iron tongue licks away my mercy bonk with second thoughts.
You are the haunted one, fool.
It's your business I do.
What do you want?
I want you to go away. I want Fiona to come along quietly, and I want Cordelia drool and taste her back. Now, can you tell me how to make those things come about? Can you? Your yammering flurry of fumes?
It can be done, said the ghost. Your answer lies with the witches of Great Burnham Wood.
Or you could just fucking tell me, said I.
No,
sang the ghost, all ghosty and ethereal. And with that, she faded away.
Leaves a chill when she goes, don't she? Said formerly Fiona. Appears to have softened your resolve, if you don't mind my saying.
The ghost saved my life last evening, said I, trying to will life back into the wan and withered.
Killed the little one, though, didn't she? Back to your bed, fool. The king's leaving on the morrow, and there's a wicked lot of work to do in the morning to prepare for his trip.
Sadly, I tucked away my tackle and sulked back to the porter's lodge to pack my kit for my final journey from the White Tower. Well, I won't miss the bloody trumpets at dawn, I can tell you that. And sod the bloody drawbridge chains rattling in my apartment before the cock crows. We might have been going to war for all the racket and goings-on at first light. Through the arrow loop, I could see Cordelia riding out with France and Burgundy, standing in the stirrups like a man, like she was off to the hunt, rather than leaving her ancestral home forever. To her credit, she did not look back, and I did not wave to her, even after she crossed the river and rode out of sight. Drool was not so fickle, and as he was led out of the castle by a rope around his neck, he kept stopping and looking back until the man-at-arms to whom he was tethered would yank him back into step. I could not bear to let him see me, so I did not go out onto the wall. Instead, I slunk back to my pallet and lay there, my forehead pressed to the cold stone wall, listening as the rest of the royals and their retinues clomped across the drawbridge below. Sod Leah, sod the royals, sod the bloody White Tower. All I loved was gone, or soon to be left behind, and all that I owned was packed in a knapsack and hung on my hook, Jones sticking out the top, mocking me with his puppety grin.
Then a knock at my door. Like dragging myself from the grave was making my way to open it. There she stood, fresh and lovely, holding a basket.
Fiona!
Kate, said Fiona. Ah, your stubbornness suits you even in daylight.
Bubble sends her sympathies over taster and drool and sends you these sweet cakes and milk for your comfort. But she says to be sure and remind you not to leave the castle without saying your farewells, and further, that you are a cur, a rascal, and a scurvy patch.
Ah, sweet Bubble. When kindness shagged an ogre, thus was she sired.
And I'm here to offer comfort myself, finishing what was started in the great hall last night. Squeak says to ask you about a small chap in a canoe.
My fee. Bit of a tart, aren't we?
Drewish, love. My people burn a virgin every autumn. One can't be too careful.
Well, all right. But I'm forlorn and I shan't enjoy it.
In that we shall suffer together. Onward. Off with your kit, fool.
What is it about me that brings out the tyrant in women, I wonder? The next morning, stretched into a week of preparation for departure from the White Tower, when Lear pronounced that he would be accompanied by 100 knights, it was not as if 100 men could mount up and ride out the gates at sunrise. Each knight, the unlanded second or third son of a noble, would have at least one squire, a page, usually a man to tend his horses, and sometimes a man-at-arms. Each had at least one war horse, a massive armoured beast, and two, sometimes three, animals to carry his armour, weapons and supplies. And Albany was 3 weeks' journey to the north, near Aberdeen. With the slow pace set by the old king and so many on foot, we'd need a crashing assload of supplies. By the end of the week, our column numbered over 500 men and boys, and nearly as many horses. We would have needed a wagon full of coin to pay everyone if Lear had not conscripted Albany and Cornwall to maintain his knights. I watched Lear pass under the Portus Lodge at the head of the column before going downstairs and climbing on my own mount, a short swayback mare named Rose.
"Mud shall not sully my black fool's motley, lest it dull his wit as well," said Lear, the day he presented the horse. I did not own the horse, of course. She belonged to the king. Oh, now his daughters, I suppose.
I fell in at the end of the column behind Hunter, who was accompanied by a long train of hounds and a wagon with a cage built on it, which held 8 of the royal falcons.
"We'll be raiding farms before we get to Leeds," said Hunter, a stout leather-clad man, 30 winters on his back. "I can't feed this lot, and they've not enough stow to last them a week."
"Cry calamity if you will, Hunter, but I'm the one to keep them in good spirits when their bellies are empty."
"Aye, I've no envy for you, fool. Is that why you ride back here with we catch farts and not in the king's side? Just drawing plans for a bawdy song at supper without the clank of armour in my ear, good Hunter?"
I wanted to tell Hunter that I was not overburdened by my duties, but by my disdain for the senile king who had sent my princess away. And I wanted time to ponder the ghost's warnings. The bit about daughters three and the king becoming a fool had come to pass, or at least was in the way of it. So the girl ghost had predicted the grave offence to daughters three, even if all the daughters had not seen the offence yet. When Lear arrived at Albany with this rowdy retinue, offence would soon follow. But what of this? When a second sibling's base derision proffers lies that cloud the vision. Did it mean the second daughter, Regan?
What did it matter if her lies clouded Lear's vision? The king was nearly blind as it was, his eyes milky with cataract. I'd taken to describing my pantomimes as I performed them so the old man would not miss the joke. And with no power, what tie could be severed that would make a difference now? A war between the two dukes? None of it about me. Why do I care?
Why then would the ghost appear to this most irrelevant and powerless fool? I puzzled it, and fell far behind the column, and when I stopped to have a wee, was accosted by a brigand. He came up from behind a fallen tree, a great bear of a fiend, his beard matted and befouled with food and burrs, a maelstrom of grey hair flying about under a wide-brimmed black hat. I may have screamed in surprise, and a less educated ear might have likened my shriek to that of a little girl.
but be assured it was most manly and more for the fair warning of my attacker, for the next I knew I'd pulled a dagger from the small of my back and sent it flying. His miserable life was saved only by my slight miscalculation of his distance. The butt of my blade bounced off his behatted noggin with a thud.
Ouch! Fuck's sake, fool, what is wrong with you?
Hold fast, knave, said I. I've two more blades at the ready, and these I'll send pointy end first, the quality of my mercy having been strained, and my ire aroused by having peed somewhat upon my shoes.
I believed it a serviceable threat.
Hold your blades, Pocket, I mean you no harm, came the voice under the hat-brim. Then, Uthraigoch Thorogochwin.
I wound up to send my second dagger to the scoundrel's heart. You may know my name, but that gargling with catsick that you're doing will not stop me from dropping you where you stand.
Udrych King Cumrud Cardenai Credid,
said the highwayman, no doubt trying to frighten me further, his consonants chained like anal beads strung out of hell's own bunghole. I may be small, but I'm not a child to be afraid of a pretend demon speaking in tongues. I am a lapsed Christian and a pagan of convenience. The worst I can do on my conscience is cut your throat and ask the forest to count it as a sacrifice come the Yule. So cease your nonsense and tell me how you know my name.
It's not nonsense, it's Welsh, said the brigand.
He folded back the brim of his hat and winked.
What say you save your wicked sting for an enemy true?
It's me, Kent, in disguise.
Indeed it was. The king's old banished friend. All of his royal trappings but his sword gone. He looked like he'd slept in the woods the week since I'd last seen him.
Kent, what are you doing here?
You're as good as dead if the king sees you. I thought you'd be in France by now.
I've no place to go. My lands and title are forfeit. What family I have would risk their own lives to take me in. I have served Lear these 40 years. I am loyal and I know nothing else. My thought is to affect accents and hide my face until he has a change of heart.
Is loyalty a virtue when paid to virtue, stranger? I think not. Lear has misused you. You are mad, or stupid, or you lust for the grave, but there is no place for you, good greybeard, in the company of the king.
And there is for you. Or did I not see you restrained and dragged from the hall for that same offence, truth told boldly? Don't preach virtue to me, fool. One voice can, without fear, call the king on his folly. And here he stands, pursued, 2 leagues back from the train.
Fuck stockings.
Truth is a surly shrew sometimes. He was right, of course, loudmouth old bull.
Have you eaten?
Not for 3 days.
I went to my horse and dug into my satchel for some hard cheese and an apple I had left from Bubble's farewell gift. I gave them to Kent.
Come not too soon, said I. Lear still fumes about Cordelia's honest offence and your supposed treason.
Follow behind to Albany's castle. I'll have Hunter leave a rabbit or a duck beside the road for you every day. Do you have flint and steel?
Aye, and tinder.
I found the stub of a candle in the bottom of my bag and handed it to the old knight. Burn this, and catch the soot upon your sword, then rub the black into your beard. Cut your hair short and blacken it too. Lear can't see clearly more than a few feet away, so keep your distance and carry on with that ghastly Welsh accent.
Perhaps I'll fool the old man, but what are the others?
No righteous man thinks you a traitor, Kent. But I don't know all of these knights, nor which might reveal you to the king. Just stay out of sight, and by the time we reach Albany's castle, I'll have flushed out any knave who might betray your cause.
You're a good lad, Pocket. If I've shown you disrespect in the past, I'm sorry.
Don't grovel, Kent. It doesn't wear well on the aged. A swift sword and a strong shield are allies I can well use with scoundrels and traitors weaving intrigue about like the venomous spider whore of Killarney.
Spider whore of Killarney? Well, I've never heard of her.
Aye, well, sit on that down tree and eat your lunch. I'll spin the tale for you like it was a web from her own bloody bum.
You'll fall behind the column.
Sod the column. That tottering old tosspot so slows them they'll be leaving a snail trail soon. Sit and listen, Greybeard. By the way, have you ever heard of Great Burnham Wood?
Aye. It's not 2 miles from Albany.
Really? How do you feel about witches?
8. A wind from fucking France. Hunter was right, of course. He wasn't able to feed Lear's train. We imposed on villages along the way for fare and quarter. But north of Leeds, the villages had suffered bad harvests, and they could not bear our appetites without starving themselves. I tried to foster good cheer among the knights, while keeping distance from Lear. I had not forgiven the old man for disowning my Cordelia and sending away Drool. Secretly, I relished the soldiers' complaints about their lack of comfort, and made no real effort to dampen their rising resentment for the old king. On the 15th day of our march, outside of Lint-upon-Tweed, they ate my horse. "Rose, Rose, Rose, would a horse by any other name taste so sweet?" the knights chanted. They thought themselves clever, slinging such jests while spraying roasted bits of my mount from their greasy lips. The dull always seek to be clever at the fool's expense, to somehow repay him for his cutting wit, but never are they clever, and often are they cruel. Which is why I may never own things, never care for anyone, nor show desire for anything, lest some ruffian thinking he is funny take it away. I have secret desires, wants and dreams, though. Jones is a fine foil, but I should like some day to own a monkey. I would dress him in a tiny jester's suit of red silk, I think. I would call him Jeff, and he would have his own scepter that would be called Tiny Jeff. Yes, I should very much like a monkey. He would be my friend, and it would be forbidden to murder, banish, or eat him. Foolish dreams? We were met at the gate of Castle Albany by Goneril's steward, adviser, and chief toady, that most pernicious twat, Oswald. I'd had dealings with the rodent-faced mucksucker when he was but a footman at the White Tower, when Goneril was still princess at court, and I, a humble jongleur, was found wandering naked amid her royal orbs. But that tale is best left for another time. The scoundrel at the gate impedes our progress. Spidery in appearance as well as disposition, Oswald lurks even when in the open, lurking being his natural state of locomotion. A fine black fuzz he wears for a beard, the same as on his head when his blue tartan tam is humbled at his heart, which it was not that day. He neither removed his hat nor bowed as Lear approached. The old king was not pleased. He stopped the train an arrow shot from the castle and waved me forward.
"Pocket, go see what he wants," said Lear. "Ask why there is no fanfare for my arrival."
"But, Nuncle," said I, "shouldn't the captain of the guard be the one?"
"Go on, fool. A point is to be made about respect. I send a fool to meet this rascal and put him in his place. Spare no manners. Remind the dog that he is a dog."
"Aye, Majesty." I rolled my eyes at Captain Curran, who almost laughed, then stopped himself, seeing that the king's anger was real. I pulled Jones from my satchel and sallied forth, my jaw set, as determined as the prow of a warship.
"Hail Castle Albany," I called. "Hail Albany! Hail Goneril!"
Oswald said nothing, did not so much as remove his hat. He looked past me to the king, even when I was standing an arm's length from him. I said, "King of bloody Britain here, Oswald, I suggest you pay proper respect."
"I'll not lower myself to speak with a fool."
"Primping little horse and wanker, isn't he?" said the puppet Jones.
"Aye," said I. Then I spotted a guard in the barbican, looking down on us.
"Hail, Cap'n! Seems someone's emptied a privy on your drawbridge, and the steaming pile blocks our way."
The guard laughed. Oswald fumed.
"Milady has instructed me to instruct you that her father's knights are not welcome in the castle."
"That's so. She's actually talking to you, then?"
"I'll not have an exchange with an impudent fool."
"He's not impudent," said Jones. "With proper inspiration, the lad sports a woody as stout as a mooring pin. Ask your lady."
I nodded in agreement with the puppet, for he is most wise for having a brain of sawdust.
"Impudent, impudent, not impotent,"
Oswald frothing a bit now.
"Oh, well, why didn't you say so?"
said Jones.
"Yes, he's that."
"To be sure," said I.
"Aye,"
said Jones.
"Aye," said I.
The king's rabble shall not be permitted in the castle.
Aye, that's so, Oswald. I reached up and patted his cheek. You should have ordered trumpets and rose petals scattered on our path. I turned and waved the advance to the train. Curran spurred his horse and the column galloped forward. Now get off the bridge or be trampled, you rat-faced little twat. I strode past Oswald into the castle, pumping Jones in the air as if I was leading cadence for war drummers. I think I should have been a diplomat. As Leah rode by, he clouted Oswald on the head with his sheathed sword, knocking the unctuous steward into the moat. I felt my anger for the old man slip a notch. Kent, his disguise now completed by nearly 3 weeks of hunger and living in the outdoors, fell in behind the train as I had instructed. He looked lean and leathery now, more like an older version of Hunter than the old, overfed knight he had been at the White Tower. I stood to the side of the gate as the column entered and nodded to him as he passed.
I'm hungry, Pocket. All I had to eat yesterday was an owl.
Perfect fare for witch-finding, methinks.
You're with me to Great Burnham Wood tonight, then?
After supper.
Aye, if Goneril doesn't poison the lot of us.
Ah, Goneril, Goneril, Goneril. Like a distant love chant is her name. Not that it doesn't summon up memories of burning urination and putrid discharge, but what romance worth the memory is devoid of the bittersweet? When I first met her, Goneril was but 17, and although betrothed to Albany from the age of 12, she had never seen him. A curious, round-bottomed girl, she had spent her entire life in and around the White Tower, and she'd developed a colossal appetite for knowledge of the outside world, which somehow she thought she could sate by grilling a humble fool. It started on odd afternoons, when she would call me to her chambers, and with her ladies-in-waiting in attendance, ask me all manner of questions her tutors had refused to answer.
"Lady," said I am but a fool. Shouldn't you ask someone with position?
Mother is dead, and father treats us like porcelain dolls. Everyone else is afraid to speak. You are my fool. It is your duty to speak truth to power.
Impeccable logic, lady. But truth be told, I'm here as fool to the little princess.
I was new to the castle, and did not want to be held accountable for telling Goneril something that the king didn't wish her to know.
Well, Cordelia is having her nap, so until she wakes, you are my fool. I so decree it.
The ladies clapped at the royal decree. Again, irrefutable logic, said I, to the thick but comely princess. Proceed.
Pocket, you have travelled the land. Tell me, what is it like to be a peasant?
Well, milady, I've never been a peasant, strictly speaking, but for the most part I'm told it's wake early, work hard, suffer hunger, catch the plague and die, then get up the next morning and do it all again.
Every day?
Well, if you're a Christian, on Sunday you get up early, go to church, suffer hunger until you have a big meal of barley and swill, then catch the plague and die.
Hunger? Is that why they seem so wretched and unhappy?
That would be one of the reasons. But there's much to be said for hard work, disease, run-of-the-mill suffering, and the odd witch-burning or virgin sacrifice, depending on your faith.
If they're hungry, why don't they just eat something?
That is an excellent idea, m'lady. Someone should suggest that.
Oh, I shall make a most excellent duchess, I think. The people will praise me for my wisdom.
Most certainly, m'lady, said I.
Your father married his sister then, did he, love?
Heavens no. Mother was a Belgian princess. Why do you ask?
Heraldry is my hobby. Go on.
Once we were inside the main curtain wall of Castle Albany, it was clear that we would go no farther. The main keep of the castle stood behind yet another curtain wall and had its own drawbridge over a dry ditch rather than a moat. The bridge was lowering even as the king approached. Goneril walked out on the drawbridge unaccompanied, wearing a gown of green velvet, laced a bit too tightly. If the intent was to lessen the rise of a bosom, it failed miserably, and brought gasps and guffaws from several of the knights until Curran raised his hand for silence.
"Father, welcome to Albany," said Goneril,
All hail good king and loving father.
She held out her arms, and the anger drained from Leah's face. He climbed down from his horse. I scampered to the king's side and steadied him. Captain Curran signalled, and the rest of the train dismounted.
As I straightened Leah's cape about his shoulders, I caught Goneril's eye. "Mr. Pumpkin."
"Knave," she said, under her breath.
"She was always the most fair of the three," I said to Leah, "and certainly the most wise."
"My lord means to accidentally hang your fool, father."
"Ah, well, if accident, there's no fault but fate," said I, with a grin, pert and nimble spirit of mirth that I am.
"But call then for a spanking of fate's fickle bottom and hit it, good lady."
I winked and smacked the horse's rump.
Wit's arrow hit, and Goneril blushed.
"I'll see you hit, you wicked little dog."
"Enough of that," said Leah. "Leave the boy alone. Come give your father a hug."
Jones barked enthusiastically and chanted,
"A fool must hit it. A fool must hit it. Hit it good."
The puppet knows a lady's weakness.
"Father," she said,
"I'm afraid we've accommodation only for you in the castle. Your knights and others will have to make do in the outer bailey, with quarters and food for them by the stables."
"But what about my fool?"
"Your fool can sleep in the stable with the rest of the rabble."
"So be it."
Leah let his eldest lead him into the castle like a milk cow by the nose ring.
"She truly loathes you, doesn't she?" said Kent. He was busy wrapping himself around a pork shoulder the size of a toddler,
his Welsh accent actually sounding more natural through the grease and gristle than when clear.
"Not to worry, lad," said Curran, who had joined us by our fire. "We'll not let Albany hang you, will we, lads?"
Soldiers all around us cheered, not sure what they were cheering for beyond the fact that they were enjoying the first full meal with ale that they'd had since leaving the White Tower. A small village was housed inside the bailey, and some of the knights were already wandering off in search of an alehouse and a whore. We were outside the castle, but at least we were out of the wind, and we could sleep in the stables, which the pages and squires had mucked out on our arrival.
"But if we are not welcome in the great hall, then they are not welcome to the talents of the king's fool," said Curran. "Sing us a song, Pocket." A cheer went up round the camp. "Sing, sing, sing!"
Kent raised an eyebrow.
"Go ahead, lad. Your witches will wait."
"I am what I am."
I drained my flagon of ale, set it by the fire, then whistled loudly, jumped up, did three somersaults, and laid out into a backflip, wherefrom I landed with Jones pointed at the moon and said, "A ballad, then." "Aye," came the cheer.
And ever so sweetly, I crooned the lilting love song, "Shall I Shag My Lady Upon the Shire?" I followed that with a bit of a narrative song by way of a troubadour tradition, "The Hanging of Willy Wagging William." Well, everyone likes a story after supper, and by the one-eyed balls of the Cyclops, that one got them clapping, so I slowed it down a bit with the solemn ballad, "Dragon Spooge Befouled My Bonny Bonny Lass." Bloody inconsiderate to leave a train of fighting men fighting back tears, so I danced my way around the camp while singing the shanty, "Alehouse Lily, She'll Bonk You Silly." I was about to say goodnight and head out when Curran called for silence, and a road-worn herald, wearing a great golden fleur-de-lis on his chest, entered the camp. He unrolled his scroll and read,
"Hear ye, hear ye. Let it be known that King Philip the 27th of France is dead. God rest his soul. Long live France. Long live the king."
No one long lived the king back at him, and he seemed disappointed, although one knight did murmur, "So?" and another, "Good bloody riddance."
"Well, you British pig dogs, Prince Jeff is now king," said the herald.
We all looked at each other and shrugged.
"And Princess Cordelia of Britain is now Queen of France," the herald added, rather huffy now.
"Oh," said many, realizing at last at least a glancing relevance.
"Jeff," said I. "The bloody frog prince is called Jeff."
I strode to the herald and snatched the scroll out of his hand. He tried to take it back and I clouted him with Jones.
"Calm, lad," said Kent, taking the scroll from me and handing it back to the herald.
"Merci," he said to the messenger.
"He took my bloody princess and my monkey's name," said I, taking another swing with Jones, which missed its mark as Kent was dragging me away.
"You should be pleased," said Kent. "Your lady is the Queen of France.
And don't think she's not going to rub my nose in that when I see her.
Come, lad. Let's go find your witches. We'll want to be back by morning in time for Albany to accidentally hang you."
"Oh, she'd like that, wouldn't she?"
Nine. Toil and Trouble.
"So why is it that we're going to Great Burnham Wood to look for witches?" asked Kent, as we made our way across the moor. There was only a slight breeze, but it was bloody cold, what with the mist and the gloom and my despair over King Geoff. I pulled my woolen cape around me. "Bloody Scotland," said I. "Albany is possibly the darkest, dampest, coldest bloody crevice in all of Blighty. Sodding Scots."
"Witches," reminded Kent.
"Because the bloody ghost told me I'd find my answers here."
"Ghost?"
"The girl ghost at the White Tower. Keep up, Kent. Rhymes and riddles and such. I told him of the grave offence to daughters three, and the madman rising to lead the blind." Kent nodded, as if he understood.
"And I'm along because..."
"Because it is dark and I am small."
"You might have asked Curran or one of the others. I'm reticent about witches."
"Nonsense. They're just like physicians, only without the bleeding. Nothing to fear."
"In the day when Lear was still Christian, we did not do well by witches. I've had a cartload of curses cast on me."
"Not very effective, though, were they? Your child frighteningly old and still strong as a bull."
"I am banished, penniless, and live under the threat of death upon discovery of my name."
"Oh, good point. Brave of you to come, then."
"Aye, thanks, lad, but I'm not feeling it.
What's that light?"
There was a fire ahead in the wood, and figures moving around it. "Stealthy now, good Kent. Let us creep up silently and see what is to be seen before revealing ourselves. Now creep, Kent, you crashing great ox. Creep." And with but two steps, my strategy revealed its flaw.
"You're jingling like a coin purse possessed of fits," said Kent. "You couldn't creep up on the deaf nor dead. Silence your bloody bells, Pocket."
I placed my coxcomb on the ground. "I can leave my hat, but I'll not take off my shoes.
We'll surrender all stealth if I'm screaming from trodding tender-footed across lizards, thorns, hedgehogs and the lot."
"Here then," said Kent, pulling the remains of the pork shoulder from his satchel.
"Dampen your bells with the fat."
I raised an eyebrow quizzically, an unappreciated and overly subtle gesture in the dark, then shrugged and began working the suet into the bells at my toes and ankles. "There." I shook a leg to the satisfying sound of nothing at all. "Forward." Creep we did, until we were just outside the halo of firelight. Three bent-backed hags were walking a slow circle around a large cauldron, dropping in twisted bits of this and that as they chanted.
"Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble."
"Witches," whispered Kent,
paying tribute to the god of all things bloody fucking obvious.
"Aye," said I, in lieu of clouting him. Jones stayed behind to guard my hat.
"Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog, adder's fork and blind worm's sting, lizard's leg and owl its wing. For a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth boil and bubble."
They double-bubbled the chorus, and we were readying ourselves for another verse of the recipe, when I felt something brush against my leg. It was all I could do not to cry out. I felt Kent's hand on my shoulder.
"Steady, lad. It's just a cat."
Another brush and a meow. Two of them now, licking my bells and purring. It sounds more pleasant than it was.
"It's the bloody pork fat," I whispered.
A third feline joined the gang. I stood on one foot, trying to hold the other above their heads, but while I'm an accomplished acrobat, the art of levitation still eludes me. Thus my ground-bound foot became my Achilles' heel, as it were. One of the fiends sank its fangs into my ankle. "Fuck stockings," said I, somewhat emphatically. I hopped, I whirled, I made disparaging remarks toward all creatures of the feline aspect. Hissing and yowling ensued. When at last the cat retreated, I was sitting splay-legged by the fire. Kent stood next to me with his sword drawn and ready, and the three hags stood in ranks across the cauldron from us.
"Back, witches," said Kent. "You may curse me into a toad, but they'll be the last words out of your mouths while your heads are attached."
"Witches?"
said the first witch, who was greenest of the three.
"What witches? We are but humble washerwomen making our way in the wood." "Rendering laundry service, humble and good," said witch two, the tallest. "All it be is as it should," said witch three, who had a wicked wart over her right eye.
"By Hecate's nightard nipples, stop rhyming," said I. "If you're not witches, what was that curse you were bubbling about?"
"Stew," said Warty. "Stew, stew, most true," said Tall. "Stew, most blue," said Green.
"It's not blue," said Kent, looking into the cauldron. "More of a brown."
"I know," said Green. "But brown doesn't rhyme, does it, love?"
"I'm looking for witches," said I.
"Really?" said Tall.
"I was sent by a ghost." The hags looked at one another, then back at me.
"Ghost told you to bring your laundry here, did it?" said Warty.
"You're not washerwomen, you're bloody witches, and that's not stew, and the bloody ghost of the bloody white tower said to seek you here for answers, so can we get about it, you gnarled knots of erect vomitus?"
"Ah, we're toads for sure now," sighed Kent.
"Always a bloody ghost, innit?" said Tall. "What did she look like?"
asked Green. "Who? The ghost?"
"I didn't say it was a she." "What did she look like, fool?"
snarled Warty.
"I suppose I shall pass my days eating bugs and hiding under leaves until some crone drops me in a cauldron," mused Kent, leaning on his sword now, watching moths dart into the fire.
"She was ghostly pale," said I, "all in white, vaporous, with fair hair and—"
"She was fit, though?" asked Tall. "Lovely, you might even say."
"Bit more transparent than I care for in my wenches, but aye, she was fit."
"Aye,"
said Warty, looking to the others who huddled with her. When they came up, Green said,
"State your business, then, fool. Why did the ghost send you here?"
"She said you could help me. I'm fool to the court of King Lear of Britain. He has sent away his youngest daughter, Cordelia, of whom I'm somewhat fond. He's given my apprentice fool, Drool, to that blackguard bastard Edmund of Gloucester, and my friend Taster has been poisoned and is quite dead."
"And don't forget that they're going to hang you at dawn," added Kent.
"Don't concern yourselves with that, ladies," said I. "About to be hanged is my status quo, not a condition that requires your repair." The hags huddled again. There was much whispering and a bit of hissing. They broke their conference, and Warty, who was the apparent coven leader, said,
"That Lear's a nasty piece of work. Last time he went Christian, a score of witches were drowned," said Tall.
Kent nodded and looked at his shoes.
The Petite Inquisition, not a high point.
"Aye. We were a decade spelling them all back to life for the revenge," said Warty. "Rosemary here still seeps pond water from the ears on damp days," said Tall. "Aye, and carps ate my small toes while I was pond bottom," said Green. "Her toes thus gefilted, we had to seek an enchanted lynx and take two of his for replacement."
Rosemary, who was Green, nodded gravely.
"Goes through shoes in a fortnight, but there's no better witch to chase a squirrel up a tree," said Tall. "That's true," said Rosemary. "Beats the burnings, though," said Warty. "Aye, that's true," said Tall. "No amount of cat toes will fix you if you've all your bits burned off. Leah had him some burnings as well.
I'm not here on behalf of Leah, said I. I'm here to correct the madness he's done.
Well, why didn't you say so? Said Rosemary.
We're always keen on sending a bit of the mayhem Leah's way, said Warty. Shall we curse him with leprosy?
By your leave, ladies, I don't wish the old man's undoing, only the undoing of his deeds.
A simple curse would be easier, said Tall. A bit of bat spittle in the cauldron, and we can have him walking on duck feet before breakfast. Make him quack, too, if you've a shilling or a freshly strangled infant for the service.
I just want my friends and my home back, said I.
Well, if you can't be persuaded, let us have a consult, said Rosemary. Parsley, sage, a moment.
She waved the other witches over to an old oak, where they whispered.
Parsley, sage, and rosemary, said Kent. What, no time?
Rosemary wheeled on him.
Oh, we've the time if you've the inclination, handsome.
Jolly good show, hag, said I. I like these crones. They're a fine-edged wit. Rosemary rolled her good eye at the Earl, lifted her skirts, aimed her withered bottom at Kent, and rubbed a palsied claw over it.
Round and firm, good knight. Round and firm.
Kent gagged a little and backed away a few steps.
God save us! Away, you ghastly carbuncled tart!
I would have looked away. Should have. But I'd never seen a green one. A weaker man might have plucked out his own eyes, but being a philosopher, I knew the sight could never be unseen, so I persevered. Hop on, Kent, said I. Beast-shagging is thy calling, and thou surely have been called. Kent backed into a tree and half-cold-cocked himself. He slid down the trunk, dazed. Rosemary dropped her skirts.
Just having you on.
The crones cackled as they huddled again.
We've a proper toading for you once the fool's business is finished, though. A moment, please.
The witches whispered for a moment, then resumed their march around the cauldron.
Nose of Turk and Tartar's lips, griffin spunk and monkey hips, mandrake rubbed with tiger nads, to divine undoing for the old king mad. Oh, bollocks, said Sage. We're all out of monkey hips.
Parsley looked into the cauldron and gave it a stir.
We can make do without them. You could substitute a fool's finger.
No, said I.
Well, then, get a finger from that comely hunk of man-meat with the boot-black on his beard. He seems foolish enough.
No, said Kent, still a tad dazed. And it's not boot-black. It's a clever disguise.
The witches looked to me.
There's no counting on accuracy without the monkey hips or fool's finger, said Rosemary.
I said, let us make do and gallantly bugger on, shall we, ladies?
All right, said Parsley, but don't blame us if we bollocks up your future.
There was more stirring and chanting in dead languages, and no little bit of wailing. And finally, when I was about to doze off, a great bubble rose in the cauldron, and when it burst, it released a cloud of steam that formed itself into a giant face, not unlike the tragedy mask used by travelling players. It glowed against the misty night.
"Hello,"
said the giant face, sounding cockney and a little drunk. "Hello, large and steamy face," said I.
"Fool, fool, you must save the drool. Quick to Gloucester, or blood will cool."
"Oh, for fuck's sake, this one rhymes too," said I to the witches. "Can't a bloke find a straightforward prose apparition?"
"Quiet, fool,"
snapped Sage, who I was back to thinking of as Warty. To the face she said,
"Apparition of darkest power. We're clear on the where and the what. But the fool was hoping for some direction of the how variety."
"Aye, sorry," said the large steamy face. "I'm not slow, you know. Your recipe was short a monkey hip."
"We'll use two next time," said Sage.
"Well, all right then."
To reverse the will of a flighty king, remove his train to clip his wings, to eldest daughters knights be dower, and soon a fool will yield the power.
The steamy face grinned. I looked at the witches. So I'm to somehow get Goneril and Regan to take Leah's knights in addition to everything else they have?
He never lies, said Rosemary.
He's often wildly fucking inaccurate, said Parsley, but not a liar.
Again, said I to the apparition, good to know what to do and all, but a method to the madness would be most welcome as well. A strategy, as it were.
Cheeky little bastard, isn't he?
Said Steamy to the witches.
Want us to put a curse on him? Asked Sage.
No, no. The lad's a rocky road ahead without adding a curse to slow him.
The apparition cleared his throat, or at least made the throat-clearing noise, as strictly speaking he had no throat.
A princess to your will shall bend, if seduction in a note you send, and fates of kings and queens shall tell, when bound our passions with a spell.
With that, the apparition faded away. That's it then, I asked. A couple of rhymes and we're finished. I have no idea what I'm to do.
Bit thick yourself, then, are you?
Said Sage.
You're to go to Gloucester. You're to separate Lear from his knights and see that they're under the power of his daughters. Then you're to write letters of seduction to the princesses and bind their passions with a magic spell. Couldn't be any clearer if it was rhymed.
Kent was nodding and shrugging, as if the bloody obviousness of it all had sluiced through the wood in an illuminating deluge, leaving me the only one dry. Oh, do fuck off, you grey-bearded sot. Where would you get a magic spell to bind the bitch's passion?
Them, said Kent, pointing rudely at the hags.
Ass,
said the hags in chorus.
Oh,
said I, letting the flood wash over me.
Of course.
Rosemary stepped forward and hailed forth three shriveled grey orbs, each about the size of a man's eye. I did not take them, fearing they might be something as disgusting as they appeared to be, desiccated elf scrotums or some such.
Puffballs from a fungus that grows deep in the wood, said Rosemary. In lover's breath these spores release, an enchanting charm you shall unleash, passion which can never be broken for him whose name next is spoken.
So, to recap, simply and without rhyme.
Squeeze one of these.